Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Sod 1 of For the Record program number 591, titled Miscellaneous Articles and Updates, being recorded on April 1st of the year 2007. Before we get to the program itself, listeners are encouraged most emphatically to make use of the vast amount of material that's available on the web. If you're only listening to the audio shows themselves, you're missing the better part of the For the Record experience, so to speak. There is a vast amount of information, including article-length descriptions of the programs, a blog sphere, an increasingly voluminous and useful FTR, For the Record supplemental file containing photos and entire articles sometimes made available for fair use. This is all available for free and no money is made off of it. There are books, old anti-fascist books, more than a half century old, available online, as well as vast amounts of audio and printed material at various URLs. So please use the website. And if you are only listening to the audio files, be aware that Spitfire has the four most recently distributed For the Record shows available for download, and sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, has been archiving the entire For the Record series on real audio. Okay, well, as this program's title indicates, this will be an updating of various topics that have been covered in past broadcasts. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that is not only very disturbing and revealing in and of itself, but which points forward. It augurs very darkly for the future in a number of ways. What this is the story of the late Jeremiah Duggan, D-U-G-G-A-N, perhaps pronounced Duggan, I don't know. I've never heard it spoken aloud. I'm going to call him Duggan. The gentleman is a young fellow, is no longer alive. He traveled to Wiesbaden, Germany, and there hooked up with what he figured was an anti-war rally or organization and ongoing enterprise. Turned out it was being run by the Schiller Institute, which is the foundation of the LaRouche organization, a fascist organization that has a very large and growing presence here in the United States. It's quite crafty, and some of their better material is, it's fairly formidable. Some of their scholarship is excellent, but sooner or later it all gets twisted, and it's all the Jews, including Hitler, by the way. The LaRouche organization has been making considerable inroads in the so-called progressive political sector. Again, note my choice of words. In particular, a LaRoucheite named Webster Tarpley has become one of the luminaries of the, quote, 911 truth movement, unquote. He's also been very much present in other, quote, progressive, unquote, media places. Pacifica Radio has had a lot of Tarpley. Online Journal features his material. And he's become something of a luminary. He is a LaRoucheite. One of the things that is dangerous, aside from the fact that furthering the efforts of the LaRouche organization is furthering the efforts of fascism, frankly. In that regard, the book by, I thought it might be Dennis King, anyway, the author's last name is King. It's called Lyndon LaRouche and the New American Fascism. Again, the author's last name is King. It might be Dennis King. I'd have to go back and double-check that, going off the top of my head here. But in any event, that book is among the sources that one could utilizes a lot of information about LaRouche. Years ago, his Labor Party began, they took military training at the late Mitch Werbel's Cobra School down in Georgia. Mitch Werbel, known as the Thomas Edison of silenced weapons or the Wizard of Whispering Death, longtime covert operative, inventor of the Ingram Mach-10 and Mach-11 machine pistols, and LaRouche's people used to the U.S. Labor Party was the name of their old labor front. They used to take military training with Werbel. As the incorporation of LaRouche and other similar organizations into the, quote, anti-war movement, again, note the quotes, and this is also not to say that there are not plenty of legitimate and concerned peace activists. Of course there are. But unfortunately, I think an awful lot of the institutionalized, quote, progressive, unquote, sector has been at careless at best, if not deliberately conspiratorial, in hooking up with elements like the LaRouches. And the result of passing institutions like the LaRouche Organization or some of their operatives off as peachy keen can eventually have these sorts of results that it had for the late Jeremiah Dugan. Another thing that is worth noting here is the collaboration at an operational level between the fascist LaRouche Organization and elements of the German police establishment and forensic establishment as well. The latter is perhaps the most alarming. And once again, when I talk about an underground Reich, and people can now read Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, for themselves, it's available on the Spitfire website for free. When I talk about an underground Reich, I bloody well mean exactly that. I mean an underground Reich. The Mafia began as a resistance movement in 12th and 13th century Sicilies to first Norse and then Saracen invaders, basically Vikings and Turks. And then, I'll bet it remained underground and flourished for to the present time. And that organization, which began in the 12th and 13th century in Sicily, is not only present in Sicily in the 21st century, it's very much present here. One could come to understand the Underground Reich and the Bormann Capital and political organization in a similar manner. So with that introduction, I'm now going to read in its entirety an article from The Observer of London. It's by Mark Townsend and Jamie Doward. It's headlined, it's dateline March 25th of 2007, headlined, "New evidence shows, quote, suicide, unquote, student was beaten to death." It reads, "Compelling new evidence suggests that a 22-year-old Briton who had become involved with a right-wing political cult in Germany was murdered, contradicting the authorities' verdict of suicide. Two new reports from leading forensic pathologists suggest that Jeremiah Dugan, a student at the British Institute in Paris, was battered to death with a blunt instrument as he tried desperately to defend himself. The findings, to be revealed on Tuesday, cast grave doubt on the official verdict that Dugan hurled himself in front of cars on a dual carriageway in Wiesbaden. Forensic specialists found no trace of tire marks on his body or anything to suggest that he had been struck by a vehicle. But they did detect classic defense wounds to Dugan's forearms and hands, which usually suggest someone trying to protect himself. His head injuries are consistent with being beaten and, quote, exclude any possibility that the injuries to his head occurred because a motor vehicle ran over the body," unquote, according to the two studies. Both reports were unanimous in rejecting the official account that Dugan was struck by two vehicles on the night he died in March of 2003. They also found that he ingested quantities of blood. The official account by German authorities, based on police reports, says he was hit by a car traveling at 60 miles per hour and died instantly. However, the fact that Dugan survived long enough to swallow large amounts of blood indicates he took a long time to die, which would not be the case after a high-speed collision. The expert conclusions are the strongest evidence yet that Dugan was killed rather than committed suicide, and support his family's claim that the true circumstances surrounding his death have been covered up. The findings will be sent this week to the Attorney General as part of a submission of evidence aimed at securing a fresh inquest into the circumstances surrounding the death. Erica, his mother, hopes that a verdict of unlawful killing will apply pressure for a fresh police investigation. Dugan, from Golders Green, northwest London, had become involved with the Wiesbaden followers of Lyndon LaRouche, an American millionaire with virulent anti-Semitic views. Unaware of the group's leanings, the former Christ's Hospital pupil told followers that he was Jewish. At 4:20 a.m. on the 27th of March, 2003, Dugan rang his mother. His voice was hushed. "Mum, I am in deep trouble," unquote. Asked where he was, Dugan began spelling out Wiesbaden. Before he could reach B, the line went dead. Hours later, police investigated reports of a body on the B-455 outside Wiesbaden. The authorities quickly pronounced Dugan's death as a clear case, unquote, of suicide. The official version states that Dugan ran against, unquote, a Peugeot, and was subsequently run over by a Golf. Despite requests by British police, their German counterparts have failed to even reveal records of when they were first alerted that Dugan had been killed in a road traffic accident. Francis Swain of lawyers Lee, Day and Company said, quote, "It is clear from the new evidence that J.D. did not die in a road traffic accident. How he did die has yet to be investigated, and a fresh inquest is required to get those proper investigations off the ground. This is strong evidence that again questions what has been told to us. A new inquest is essential," unquote. And there is a summary of the major points in this investigation. 21st of March, summary is titled, by the way, Fight for Justice. It reads, 21st of March, 2003, Jeremiah Dugan travels to Wiesbaden for what he believes is an anti-war conference. This, of course, would have been in the immediate run-up to the, or actually, I guess, 21st of March would have been right at the time of the beginning of the Iraq War. Beginning again, 21st of March, 2003, Jeremiah Dugan travels to Wiesbaden for what he believes is an anti-war conference. In fact, it was organized by the far-right Schiller Institute, which is inspired by Lyndon LaRouche, a U.S. right-wing conspiracy theorist and run by his wife. It has a history of anti-Semitism. 27th of March at 4:20 a.m., Dugan, who is Jewish, called his mother saying, "I'm in deep trouble. I want out," unquote. Later, he was found dead on a dual carriageway. 29th of March, German authorities claim he took his own life by jumping into traffic. 4th of November, British coroner Dr. William Dolman dismissed suicide verdict, saying Dugan died, quote, "in a state of terror," unquote. 24th of February, 2004, Dugan family meet Foreign Office after German authorities refuse to reopen the case. November 2005, Dugan's mother persuades German authorities to hand over photos made by investigators. 22nd of February, 2006, family calls for new inquest. March 2007, two forensic reports say Dugan was battered to death. So that, folks, is the dark side of the LaRouche force. So when LaRouches wind their way through the so-called progressive sector, when the, quote, anti-war, unquote, movement begins incorporating elements like that, people want to be very careful. Because sometimes there can be some very, very serious consequences indeed. There is a fascinating article, a column really, from the Jerusalem Post. And we're going to be dealing with two separate pieces from of information from this. This is from a Carolyn Glick column in the Jerusalem Post. Jerusalem Post is one of the major English language Israeli dailies. Obviously, it also is published in Hebrew. But the Jerusalem Post is the more conservative of the Israeli dailies. Haaretz, among others, is more to the left. American political lexicon is the opposite of the rest of the world. When the rest of the world says liberal, they mean conservative / laissez-faire. We use liberal to mean left of center or progressive. It's the opposite in the rest of the world. Haaretz is the progressive Israeli daily. The Jerusalem Post, the more conservative. A very enlightening column by Carolyn Glick in a couple of respects. George Soros, speaking of the American, quote, progressive, unquote, sector in the, quote, anti-war, unquote, movement, George Soros has been very active in that. He also now is going to be very active in trying to recruit sort of a left-wing anti-Israel, sort of anti-AIPAC organization. But George Soros has a very, very interesting background. Not only has the trading of much of Soros's, and not only has a fair amount of Soros's economic activity been conducted in connection with the German economic infrastructure, invariably run by the Bormann Capital Network, but also George Soros's Quantum Fund, as we saw in the For the Record program, 578. I believe that was Vochwitz. Maybe that was 577. But an IG Farben / Bormann / underground right connected element, or apparent element, apparently so connected element, manages the Quantum Fund of George Soros. One of the things that is has been discussed in a number of For the Record programs, one of the things that is set out in the description for the Record 305, and that is part of the book Martin Borum, A Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, is the fact that one of the things that has characterized the Bormann Group is the fact that they have very deliberately utilized Jews as some of their business players. They also have tremendous influence inside of Israel. It's when one talks about things like this, by the way, that the old Turkish proverb, he who tells the truth gets chased out of nine villages, comes to mind. Last summer, and basically, although I certainly have no brief for the Israeli right, last summer, while the Lebanon war was going on, I basically stated, as is the fact, that the Israeli cause is just, though flawed, and that indeed one should find out a lot about organizations like Hezbollah. Basically, came to the defense of Israel, also pointed out that an awful lot of that coverage was quite simply dishonest. That is the sort of thing that makes what I do distasteful, because, boy, you get dumped on, and I got plenty of that. Then again, when one talks about the fascist elements in the Zionist movement, or if you really want to get investigated by the ADL, as I was in, I guess it must have been the late 80s, it came out in the early 90s in connection with the ADL spying scandal, but try talking about Bormann Jews, boy, woohoo! Look out below. Well, here goes. Maybe I'll be a twofer for the ADL on this one. I don't know, but nine villages, here I come. One of the interesting things about George Soros is that there are very credible sources, including interviews given by him, in which the fount of his largesse initially, he got his start, so to speak, working with the Third Reich in conjunction with the property appropriation program that was part of the Holocaust. Again, one of two excerpts from Carolyn Glick's Column 1, The Road to Serfdom, from the Jerusalem Post, and this is from March 22nd of 2007. Speaking of Soros, and talking about his anti-Israel efforts, one of the central players in this concerted attack has been the billionaire George Soros. Soros is an anti-Zionist Jew with a troubling past. Specifically, by his own admission in interviews with 60 Minutes in 1998 and PBS in 1993, Soros collaborated with the Nazis in seizing Jewish property in Budapest in 1944. Author Serge Trifkovich, who is currently researching a biography of Soros, tells of a Holocaust survivor in Hungary who claims that the reason Soros was allowed to remain free was, quote, the boy's special knowledge of the Jewish community and its attempts to protect its property from confiscation, unquote. Since 2003, Soros has donated more than $100 million to radical left-wing groups and to the political campaigns of far-left anti-war Democratic candidates in the U.S. His money has made him one of the most influential forces in the Democratic Party. Soros has given $100 million to groups that are quite far to the left, including some of those far-left groups that find common cause with elements like the LaRouche Organization. Do remember that the Jerusalem Post, although a credible source, is a conservative one, and it is responsible, but it has an ideological bias. So not all of the anti-war Democratic candidates in the U.S. are far left, okay? However, some of them have got some seriously screwed up attitudes, and one wonders where they get them. Again, when people are a bit lied to by the media, what are you going to do? The big lie is a very, very, very tough thing to combat. But note here Soros's beginnings. Soros, in his own autobiography, has described his days in wartime Budapest as some of the happiest of his life, which is revealing. Is the $64,000 question, is George Soros a Bormann Jew? Because one of the things that's so clever about the Bormann Group is that they use X number of Jews, and they become the more visible elements in what are basically Nazi capital interests, and people get, you know, the ignorant ones say, see, it is. The Jews own all, they got all the money, and then the Jews catch the blame for what the Nazis are doing. A great way for seducing the American left and forging it in the American progressive sector and forging it into a third position fascist stance. Third position fascism is a synthesis of far left and far right elements with a distinct pro third world and anti-American and anti-Semitic bent to it. If one wants to seduce the American left and elements of the Democratic Party and forge them into a third-position fascist entity, a good way of doing that would be to have someone who was Jewish leading the charge. So again, I ask the question, is George Soros a Bormann Jew? We will visit the subject of Bormann Jews in a broadcast later this year, and I'm sure that'll get me a twofer for the ADL, but what the hell. The old Turkish proverb again, he who tells the truth gets chased out of nine villages, and again, the Israeli cause is just, though flawed. But when I talked about the fascist element in the Zionist movement, I got investigated by the ADL, and I'm going to be talking about Borman Jews, and who knows, maybe that'll, maybe I'll go for a twofer there. We'll see. Like I say, nine villages, here I come. Fascinating article from the Washington Post of March 11th. To keep an eye on what's happening with American agriculture, with global warming, with also the possibility of weather warfare, and Project HAARP exemplifies those. That's what the patents were for altering the weather for military purposes. Keep an eye on American agriculture. Pay particular attention not only to droughts and to various things that are diminishing the American farmer, including big agri, including and especially big agribusiness and globalization. Keep an eye on what's happening to things like American honeybees. There's been a sudden die-off of American honeybees, and the problem is that threatens much of the American agriculture. Certainly, it threatens a number of different crops and has very dire implications. Indeed, what is killing the honeybees? They don't know. Something real funky has been happening to American rice as well. It's making it much less competitive internationally. And when the dust here is settling, one of the things that's becoming apparent is that it is genetically modified strains of rice coming from Bayer Crop Science and also from BASF, two of the former member companies of IG Farben, that is the culprit here. So one wonders here whether perhaps among the things that we're looking at is the deliberate subversion, and this is obviously a conspiracy theory, the deliberate subversion of elements of American agriculture by elements of the Bormann Group, the Underground Reich, which are in IG Farben, and it's the companies that grew out of it. In fact, they control it. And again, the evidence in that regard is it's scant, but you know, it's there. Pay attention to what those companies do, and pay attention to, read Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Reading between the lines, the following is a very disturbing story. If you could undermine American agriculture, that would skew the market in favor of other crop producers, say ones owned by Bormann elements, either in the U.S. or elsewhere. Washington Post, March 11th, 2007, Washington Post staff writer Rick Weiss writes, "Rice industry troubled by genetic contamination. When Fred Zonbrecker heard in August that the popular variety of long grain rice he was planning to grow had become contaminated with snippets of experimental, unapproved DNA, the Louisiana rice farmer took it in stride and ordered a different variety of seed for his spring planting. But when federal officials announced last week that the rice he and many others switched to was also contaminated, this time with a different unapproved gene, irritation grew to alarm." So again, what we have here is two unsanctioned contaminations by unapproved genetic modification, two different kinds of rice. Wait till you see who makes both. Talk about a twofer. The two sideline varieties accounted for about a third of last year's southern rice crop, and planting was set to begin with days. "Everybody's been scrambling for seeds," Zonbrecker said. "I have no idea whether it will be enough or not," unquote. The tremors going through the U.S. long grain rice industry, amplified by the decision of many biotech-wary nations to restrict imports of U.S. rice until questions of purity are resolved, have revealed how vulnerable a $1 billion agricultural sector can be to the escape of something as small as a molecule of DNA. But rice is not the only crop being affected by genetic pollution. 11 years after the first gene-altered crops got the go-ahead for U.S. planting, biotech acreage is at a record high. Almost 90% of U.S. soy and corn, as well as about 60% of U.S. cotton, is spiked with genes from other organisms, mostly to confer resistance to insects and to make the crops immune to weed-killing chemicals. Yet some of those genes have spread to weeds, making them tougher to control. Biotech crops approved only as animal feed have found their way into human food, and plants engineered to make medicines in their tissues have escaped from their test plots. "Something's not working," unquote, said Al Montna, who grows 2,500 acres of rice in California. "Something's got to change," unquote. Some farmers are pointing fingers at biotech seed producers whose carelessness, they say, has allowed experimental DNA to drift into commercial varieties, transforming U.S. rice into a global pariah and sending the industry into its biggest crisis in memory. Others are fed up with the Agriculture Department, which in the past 6 months has been scolded in 3 federal courts for not keeping adequate tabs on the burgeoning business of genetically engineered crops. Whatever the root cause, the string of recent missteps has sullied an industry that, though long controversial in much of the world, has mostly grown under the radar in the United States. Skipping down. U.S. farmers such as Zonbrecker have been caught in the middle, fighting off domestic efforts to introduce gene-altered rice until international markets warmed to the product. He was going to plant a conventional variety called Chenier on at least 500 of his more than 2,000 acres until he learned that it had been inexplicably tainted with a weed-killer-resistant gene created by Bayer Crop Science of Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, that was unapproved for rice. In its place, he ordered Clearfield 131, another non-engineered variety developed by BASF of Germany. But on March 5th, the USDA put out an emergency call to prevent all planting of that variety. Tests had found 2 laboratory-made genes not meant to be in it, one belonging to Bayer, and one that has yet to be fully identified. Bayer, BASF, 2 of the former member companies of IG Farben. And skipping down again, I'm seeing a lot of very, very angry people, unquote, said Adam Levitt, a Chicago lawyer who was involved in a class action suit against Bayer that already includes hundreds of rice farmers and millers. Bayer spokesman Greg Coffey said the company should not be blamed if the federal rules that it followed are inadequate. Quote, we do believe our work has adhered to USDA regulatory guidelines, unquote, he said, completing the circle of blame that on many farms today is as familiar as the seasons, unquote. Information about IG Farben, there's lots of it. First of all, IG Farben and the Underground Reich, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. For the record, program number 411, the Bayer Facts. That talks about recent doings vis-a-vis Bayer. Bayer, by the way, for quite some time was headed up by Carl Duisberg, the inventor of poison gas, the man for whom the Carl Duisberg Society is named. It was the vehicle for trafficking Mohammed Atta, certainly into Germany and perhaps, who knows, into the United States, and delivering him and his associates into the good auspices of Huffman Aviation in Southern California, or Southern Florida. And also, the Carl Duisberg Gesellschaft has been apparently deeply involved in anthrax research in the United States, specifically in institutions associated with the University of Delaware, perhaps in that regard, revealing, among other things, the old IG Farben-DuPont cartel connections. A number of the anti-fascist books available on the Spitfire website deal with IG Farben, including Germany's Master Plan by Borken and Welch, Treason's Peace by subtitled German Dies and American Dupes by Howard Watson Ombruster, and also The Devil's Chemists by Josiah Du Bois. All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin also talks extensively about IG Farben. Again, do make good use of the vast amount of material available on the Spitfire website, both audio and print files and books and all kinds of stuff. And also be aware that there is, and I'm going to have a link to this in the description for the record program 588 when it goes out, there is a 3-part documentary, a 3-part lecture series available on DVD called The First Refuge of a Scoundrel, The Link Between Fascism and Religion. There's a YouTube segment up about that, of that lecture, and I'm going to put on a link to that on the Spitfire website. Also, the people who are producing that are also producing a documentary about yours truly titled The Anti-Fascist, not coming to theaters near you anytime soon anyway. Particularly not if the ADL has anything to say about it, or the Muslim Brotherhood. Woohoo! Ain't we got fun? This wraps up side one of For the Record program number 591. Miscellaneous articles and updates being recorded on April 1st of the year 2007. My name's Dave Emery. No fooling.